You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex tōku ingoa, nō mai hari mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Atu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. FIRK NA coming up on the show. For Air Science this week, our expert, Professor Alan Blackman, chats with us about Japan's islands moving, nuclear clocks and recycling with barcodes. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with MP Ryan Hamilton about Housing Minister Chris Bishop's comments on social housing, the potential end of the Iran war, and the Conservation Amendment Bill. Liam, what do you have for us today?
Hi Alex. Today I spoke to Professor Richard Easter about the government's approach to science funding and the impacts that Budget 2026 and other measures will have on science and scientists in New Zealand. I also spoke to Professor Aaron Davis about Keir Starmer's recent resignation, how this came about, and what we might expect the future of the Labour Party to look like with the likely appointment of former Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham as Prime Minister.
He aha o whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ko wā e wareware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ke ēne kōrero āno, hei pakehere roki roki mā runga i te pai, tuku tuku o Irarangi Poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia timata te whakatūranga, let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we are joined by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman.
The expert.
Welcome, the expert.
The dreaded expert.
Emphasis on expert.
Oh God, don't. No.
What has the world of science got for us this week?
Well, we've got some interesting stuff, I think. We're going to start by going all the way back to the year 2011 and a thing called the Tohoku earthquake. Mm. And if we call it that, probably not too many people would be knowing which one we're talking about. But if we called it the Fukushima earthquake, then everyone would probably click.
Yeah, and that okay.
That was that massive, massive earthquake in Japan that happened. It was, you know, magnitude 9.0 on the Richter scale, which is just ridiculous. And it caused, amongst other things, the Fukushima nuclear accident and also massive tsunamis, and 20,000 people lost their lives. So it was a disaster in all senses of the word. So you might think that people would know everything that there was to know about this particular earthquake that happened, you know, 15 years ago. But remarkably, there's some scientists in the States and in France who have been analysing the data on this, because they just thought that there was something there that didn't quite make sense. And what they found was that 16 minutes after the earthquake, so normally after earthquakes you get aftershocks, okay, because all of your plates have been disturbed and everything and they're not stable, and then there'll be other smaller earthquakes, etc., etc. But 16 minutes after the big earthquake and before any aftershocks came, the GPS stations in Japan registered that the entire country moved eastwards about 6 millimeters, which just boggles the mind.
That's actually a lot. That's more than I expected.
So you can imagine the energy that it would have to take to do that. And where did that energy come from? Well, analysis of these data by these guys from the States and France say that what they reckon happened was that the initial earthquake had caused this wave of energy to go basically straight down from Japan. And so it goes down through the earth and then it hits the earth's very, very dense liquid core. So that's liquid metal. It's liquid iron or whatever in the middle of the Earth, okay? And these waves can't travel through liquid. And so what happens was that they were reflected, so it bounced basically straight back up to the crust. And when it hit the crust, it caused a slippage of tectonic plates, and that's why Japan moved 6 millimeters to the east. Okay, so all of this took, and they do the calculations and everything, all of this took 15 minutes. So the waves traveled around about 5,800 kilometers, straight down, straight up, and it released about the same sort of energy as a magnitude 7.5 quake. So we're talking sort of way stronger than the Christchurch, way stronger than both Christchurch quakes. Anyway, I think the first one was 7.1, then the one that did all the damage was 6.3. So, and remember, the Richter scale is a logarithmic scale. So, you know, one difference in the logarithmic scale is a factor of 10, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, and this hasn't been discovered till now because of all of the noise that was going on from sort of the remnants of that big quake. But there was just this sort of something in the data that caused these people to go back and have a look at it and say, hey, hang on, there's something really weird going on here. So basically, you know, you just get this massive pulse of energy just going straight down into the core of the Earth and bounces off and bam. And so, you know, this is another feature of earthquakes that I guess people are going to be considering in the future. That
Yeah, I kind of never really think about the fact that when the Earth is moving, the Earth is actually moving, and that can do things.
But to move a mass that size, 6 millimeters, my goodness, that's an unimaginable amount of energy.
That's so much.
Yeah, just incredible. I mean, so here's hoping we never have another magnitude 9 earthquake, but I'm sure that, you know, one's going to happen. Remember, our capital city is built on a fault line or very, very close to one. So one day, hate to say it.
Well, let's hope we don't move 6 millimeters.
As long as we move further from Australia.
Oh, goodness me. Harsh. Harsh. Goodness.
What have we got next?
Let's talk clocks.
Yeah,
let's
cool.
talk
love
clocks. Let's talk time. And let's talk about what we actually need for a clock. And that's probably something that you probably haven't given a heck of a lot of thought to. You know, what do we need for something that actually measures time? And the answer to that is you need some process that occurs at a constant and measurable rate. Okay? And once you've got that, then you have yourself the basis of a clock, because you can measure just time intervals relative to that constant measurable rate of whatever it is that's going on. So you think, you know, an old grandfather clock, something like that, for example. You go and, right, we've got a pendulum, haven't we? And the pendulum is swinging, and the pendulum is swinging at a constant rate, except for the fact that you've got to wind it up every now and then, don't you?
Yeah,
because dear old friction, you know, that thing that physicists love to just neglect, you know, let's assume there's no friction, et cetera, et cetera. And if there wasn't, then your pendulum would be fine, because it would just keep going forever, ever and a day. Amen. But so pendulum's all well and good, but we need something that's a little bit more constant, that's not affected by friction, et cetera, et cetera. So what you really want is some sort of natural phenomenon that you can measure. So in 1955, the first atomic clock was built, okay? And we've got a whole lot of processes that occur in atoms, all sorts of things going on there. And fortunately for us, I guess, those processes have measurable rates and constant rates, okay? And this atomic clock was built using atoms of a metal called cesium, which you may or may not have heard of. And so the process is essentially what happens. So you take these cesium atoms, and these cesium atoms are in the gas phase, and it's all very cold, and they're in a vacuum chamber, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very sort of sensitive piece of equipment. You don't want to bump it and all that sort of stuff. So you take these cesium atoms, and they are in a low energy state. And then what you're going to do is you're going to hit them with microwave radiation. Okay?
As you do.
And if you choose your microwave radiation to be of the correct frequency, then what that's going to do is some of those atoms are going to be bumped up into a higher energy state. They're going to absorb the microwave radiation and they're going to go into a high energy state. They find themselves in a high energy state. They don't want to be there. They want to be in the low energy state. And so once they've absorbed that radiation, been promoted, they then go back down. And then they absorb some more and they get excited and then they drop back down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all this promotion or excitation and then they relax and then they do it again and they do it again. And that particular process can be used as the basis of a clock, okay? Because what they were able to measure was that this particular process occurs, here we go, 9,192,631,770 times a second.
Nice and easy number.
Easy number to calculate. But you can imagine that's quite quick. You've got 9 billion times a second. But we can measure that, okay, to a very, very high degree of precision. And in fact, that is the definition of the second, the SI unit, the second. That's the unit of time that we use, okay? So a second is defined as being 9,192,631,770 occurrences of that particular process in these cesium atoms, okay? And once that number has done, that's 1 second, okay? So that's the way that we currently measure time really, 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 really accurately. And we're talking, you know, to plus or minus a second within millions of years. You know, this, the accuracy that you can get with these things is just quite remarkable. However, the problem is, as I said, that they are very, very delicate pieces of machinery. They have to be kept cold, vacuum chamber, etc., etc., etc. And they can be affected by outside fields as well. So you've got electromagnetic fields and stuff like that. That can sort of affect the operation of the whole thing. So ideally, you'd want something a little bit more robust, let's say. Okay. So some scientists have been working on this problem for quite a few years now. And this is kind of cool because... the scientists in Austria and scientists in Japan, and they have submitted papers within 4 days of each other on this massive advance in clocks. And now what they're using is not... So in the cesium atoms, what is actually happening when they are getting excited is that the electrons are rearranging. So you've got electrons in the atom, they rearrange, and then they rearrange again when they drop back down to the ground state, and then they rearrange again when they, you know, blah, 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 blah. So it's an electronic process that's going on there. The electrons in the atom are being rearranged. So these people in Austria and Japan have now figured out how to get the nucleus of the atom to rearrange, okay? So the nucleus is made of protons and neutrons, okay? And a similar sort of process can occur. So an atom can absorb... in this case, not microwave radiation. They need much more energetic radiation to be able to do that. Much harder process to do.
A little bit harder than an electron from what I remember.
Absolutely.
From high school.
And so what they need to use here is a UV laser, an ultraviolet laser. So it's much more energetic radiation. And that, again, if that's the correct frequency, that can get a rearrangement of the nucleus in these atoms and it can excite them. And then drops down, and then excite and drops down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there's only one isotope on the entire periodic table that's amenable to this, because all of the others, the energy required to do that is far too high, and they can't sort of access that easily. But thorium-229, there you go. You've never heard of thorium-229.
Of course, thorium-229.
That is the nucleus that they can rearrange with an ultraviolet laser. And the beauty is that so now we're talking atoms that are in solids, okay? So now they don't have to be kept cold. They don't have to be in sort of, you know, vacuums and blah, 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 blah. So they're going to be a lot more robust. Okay, so basically this is a proof of principle thing. So they have, between them, made the same discovery independently within 4 days of each other. Okay, now should this ever be deemed Nobel Prize worthy, you know,
that's a trick,
then the prize goes to the people who got there first. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But this has the potential to be more accurate, more precise than the current atomic clocks that we have at the moment. And we'll just see how this pans out, because this, you know, this is potentially a very, very big advance in timekeeping. And the thing is that this has not yet been peer reviewed. So neither paper has been peer reviewed. They have just been submitted and to a pre-publication website, essentially. And so they will go through the peer review process. They'll eventually be published in a journal, and then, you know, everybody will be onto that and see if they can replicate it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and improve on it. So interesting times ahead for
exciting
the time people, the horologists amongst us, I guess. Oh, I think so.
That's a fun word.
I think it's the right one.
It makes sense in my head. Yeah. Who knows? Well, hey, always good to have an exciting discovery on.
Oh, no pun. Science. No pun intended. he's onto it.
No. God. Anyway, what do we have next?
Okay, and finally, we're going to talk plastics, and we're going to talk recycling.
Pesky plastics.
Because obviously that's what we should all be doing. And if I were to ask you guys what number plastics you're meant to recycle, yep, okay, there's the shrug. Yep. And I'd have to admit to that too, I don't. No, I just, you know, anything plastic, it goes in the bin, you know, probably a bit naughty. And you're only meant to recycle types 1, 2, and 5, okay, and you do not recycle 3, 4, 6, and 7, okay. So if you are like me, you probably just sort of chuck things in the bin. You hope that it all sort of works its way out. So you think, well, what happens then? Well, it gets taken to the recycling centre or whatever, and then it's got to be all sort of basically manually separated, which does take time. So there's some folk in the USA who want to make this a better process. So, you know, you've got two ways you can go here. You can educate the general public on, you know, 1, 2, and 5. Ain't gonna happen.
But that's too hard.
Ain't gonna happen. So, given that it's probably not gonna happen, let's see if we can find a better way of identifying these plastics rapidly and being able to remove them, rather than having to just sort of hand do it and everything like that. So what they do is they look at the chemical fingerprints of these plastics, okay? So these plastics are all different. So they've got different chemical makeups. They're basically made of carbon and hydrogen and probably a little bit of oxygen, but arranged in different ways, okay? And if you shine infrared light on these things, then you find that they've got a very diagnostic, what we call chemical fingerprint. Okay, and you can basically tell what type of plastic you've got there very, very quickly, essentially almost instantaneously through interaction with infrared. Okay, so that's the way that they are proposing to do it. So they're going to use an infrared laser, or as they call it, and this is just over the top, a three-dimensional transient thermal barcode. God, we just call it infrared spectroscopy, essentially, but it does sound sexy when you say it like that. And as I say, each particular type of plastic has their own individual fingerprint. And so this could lead to very, very rapid identification of these particular types of plastic. There's obviously way more work to be done on this, but again, it's a start. And, you know, anything that, I don't know, maybe encourages people to think before they throw their plastics in the recycling bin, have a look at the number on it. If it's 1, 2, or 5, whack it in there. If it's not, then it goes in landfill. Okay, so so we'll see how this pans out. Again, you know, like many stories on Dear Science, you know, more work is necessary.
Wait and see.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, that's just the whole world, really. Let's wait and see. See if anything goes wrong.
True.
Well, thanks, Alan, for joining us. Thank you, Motat, and thank you, Science. Nā korero rererangi, Aviation Conversations returns on 2nd of July. Enjoy a lively panel discussion on the Dark Sky Movement, featuring guest speakers Nikki MacArthur, MNZM, and Josh Aoraki. Book now at motat.nz.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last week, during Scrutiny Week, Housing Minister Chris Bishop was asked about the government's changes to social housing rent in this year's budget, prompting an explanation and defence for this government's approach to social housing. last week also saw the tangible possibility of a peace deal between the US and Iran emerge, with talks progressing between the two parties to bring conflict to a close. This, of course, will have an effect on New Zealand's fuel situation, with the fuel crisis caused by the conflict having widespread effects on the country. And the Conservation Amendment Bill has roused concern and criticism over what some will lead to the selling off of a large chunk of conservation land, despite the government's comments to the contrary, as it seeks to change how conservation land is organised and how it can be sold. I spoke with National MP Ryan Hamilton about these topics, starting with Minister Chris Bishop and the government's social housing changes. Last week, Housing Minister Chris Bishop said that the government's decision to land on an increase to 30% from 25% in social housing rent was numbers-wise, not based in science. Why then is this change and this number something that the government has seen fit to land on?
I think with the whole housing situation, like as he has sort of articulated, there's been, I guess, there hasn't been much change to the system for a long time, and we know the demand on social housing is high, and some people have been in, well, they've virtually been in social housing for most of their lives with no sort of evident way of getting out of it. And so we are trying to address that as part of the whole housing system, where, you know, originally social housing and the housing system was designed to help people get on their feet or support them through, you know, tough times, but then gradually move them towards more independent living. And what we're seeing is it's becoming more of a permanent housing solution. And so we've got to make some adjustments across the dials. One of those is the we see the housing affordability piece, you know, from a government perspective as well, but also in terms of how those housing costs have shifted. Ultimately, we want everyone to have a roof over their head. But we have got to prioritise, you know, the greatest need and where there's the opportunity for people to move on and have more independence and autonomy, we're really keen to, you know, set up a system that can support that.
But when it comes to kind of helping these people move on or supporting, you know, new vulnerable people in social housing, how does raising the rents help the people who are in vulnerable positions who need social housing?
Well, we've got to remember too that although that, you know, cost might go up by 5%, you know, our accommodation support supplements and benefits have also gone up, you know, incrementally over the last 10 years with inflation and those sorts of things. So all other, their income has also proportionally gone up as well. So it is a bit of a rebalancing as well.
Looking to the increase of the accommodation supplement that came with this change, that's expected to only, I believe, it's $15. Social housing costs are expected to go up about $30 on average. That accommodation supplement is not covering this change. So is this not making the most vulnerable people spend more money on social housing?
Well, I guess the challenge is it's never linear like that. Like often there'll be multiple people in the housing, you know, situation. Some of them are also receiving different types of income or benefit. So it's, you know, it's often not binary, like this has gone up by you know, twice and this is only being raised by half. There's often a lot of complex and overlapping benefits and accommodation supports to it. And that, I guess that's part of the wider reform we're doing as well, because it's so confusing. And, you know, another example was the temporary accommodation supplement, which was designed to just sort of provide a boost for a limited time, but that's effectively being baked in. And so what it can actually do is end up having a perverse outcome, where it actually creates a dependency and a disincentive for people to earn more money and to move up the ladder. In fact, you know, there's some systems or some, you know, examples we've heard where people are discouraged from taking higher incomes or moving into private housing because they might be financially worse off. So then that puts pressure on the social housing system and actually clogs it, prevents, you know, new opportunities for people as well. So we're trying to take a holistic approach, so you sort of can't just look at one, you know, percentage or one supplement in isolation to all the others.
As talks between the US and Iran go on in an attempt to end the conflict between the two, where does the national government stand currently on New Zealand's fuel security?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously we can't be reliant on, you know, a peacemaking deal you know, because even if we get one now, or potentially there is or talks of one, there's such a big lag effect between, you know, in terms of the cost of fuel, the transportation across oceans and refineries, and you know, some economists will say it could be anywhere from 3 months to 12 months before we'll actually get the benefit or flow on of that. So I think our response has been really about resilience and security of supply, you know, ensuring we did a deal with Singapore to make sure we guarantee that sort of two-way trade, food for fuel. Obviously, we've invested in, you know, an extra 3 days of diesel fuel supply up around Marsden Point. And the Commerce Commission's also got, you know, fuel retailers on notice as well to just make sure any fluctuations and reductions are immediately passed on through to consumers. So it's really a case of continuing what we've been doing, which is, you know, around ensuring security of supply and, I guess, having not all our eggs in one basket, so to speak. And, you know, also Australia's in a similar basket. So we've built up our relationships with them in terms of leveraging off our combined scale to ensure that, you know, the sort of lower Pacific region can get as most security and resilience as we can. So, again, it's just not coming down to one single source of reliance, but trying to continue that diversification of supply, security and resilience.
And looking at the national fuel plan that's currently in place, does the government know what kind of path that will be taken with that national fuel plan if the conflict does come to an end? Like you've said, with working the lag effect, do we know what sort of path we're going to take into the future as we kind of adjust again to maybe a more stable fuel economy?
Well, I think the market will always sort of build in that uncertainty, and you're seeing that now around prices at the pump. Like, it has dropped down from the initial shock a few months ago. But I think things will, you know, price will continue to remain sticky. And so that, you know, obviously gets built into people's way of life. It might mean, you know, less discretionary spend. You know, you've seen an uptake in public transport. So there'll be variations like that, even an uptake in EV vehicles. So, you know, in some ways, the uncertainty has actually driven people to be perhaps more diligent in their, you know, transport options and choices. So, you know, the market will respond, as will we. But I think you're not going to see, well, we'd hope that you wouldn't see any rapid volatility. Just a bit more of a feathering as those, or buffer as those effects are mitigated.
And finally on this, when we look at, like you said, the diligence with transport options, moving forward, are we likely to see support from a national government into some of these alternative transport measures like public transport in preparation for any future potential shocks?
I think we'll have to wait and see. There was a little bit, you know, in the budget through, or that might not look direct in terms of transport resilience through obviously the ferries, NZTA, infrastructure spending on roading, because even in rail, because even, you know, roading with the use of EVs, we've got to have good, you know, roading infrastructure, and we supported the funding of the extension of the Cambridge to Piatowee road of national significance. And that's not just about speed, and, you know, that also improves productivity. It enables more vehicles to get from A to B. And the other thing people don't often realise is those big roads actually help to unburden some of the local roads and the congestion, which, you know, has positive effects for local transport and even cyclists and school traffic.
And finally, the Conservation Amendment Bill has caused controversy. This is a government that has been labelled and accused as anti-nature or anti-the environment, looking towards other changes such as fast-track changes and other various policies. How does the government defend from these accusations, looking to these changes to selling Department of Conservation land?
Well, it's simply not true. Like, it's a false narrative. Like, we haven't said we're going to go and sell all this conservation land. What we've said is there are pockets of land that are clearly not fit for purpose. Like, there's obviously a Met Service building in Wellington. There's a gravel pit that's been identified, or, you know, and you know, considered conservation land. And so,
But what that journey has uncovered is actually the process of the conservation estate being able to go through a process of releasing some of those bits of land needs adjusting. And so in the process, it means that anything, will have to go through a robust process. And people look at that and say, oh, you're going to sell off, all this high-value conservation land. Well, no, but the process obviously will ensure that if anyone wants to embark on that, there is a clear pathway. It doesn't mean that the appetite's there, from government to do that at all. It just means we've got to make it fit for purpose. I think it's like 60% of the land mass of New Zealand, and we've got to make sure where there's high-value conservation and tourism, we want to protect that, but where there's pockets that are no longer, serving that need, well, we've got to be look at that and address those.
But if it's focused on those pockets, why not roll out a change that is more specifically addressing these areas and not a more widespread change of how easy it is to sell conservation land?
Well, it becomes any sort of starting to pick winners and losers, and it becomes the government's, discretion of saying, well, we think this piece of land, could be put up, but it becomes, often land's implicated and correlated with other pockets or pathways or access, and it's not for the government to pick winners and losers, but we're to say, look, here's a robust process that you would need to go through. It doesn't make it easier. In fact, I know the Minister of Conservation's making sure there's good iwi land consultation, and in some ways it could be more difficult to actually offload that land, but the point is the process will be clearer. And I think that's what's getting, misconstrued and saying, we're just getting rid of all this land, which is just simply not true.
Looking to that, a poll has shown that 2/3 of New Zealanders may oppose the selling of conservation land. The National Party have said that this change isn't aimed at selling conservation land, but do they understand why New Zealanders are potentially concerned with that angle based on the kind of change that's being brought about?
Yeah, I mean, you've got agencies like Forest and Bird that they'll take something out of context and say, we're getting rid of New Zealand land, and it becomes political, it's an election year. But, National Party had long time supported conservation and national parks and biodiversity, and we want to protect and preserve that. But we've also got to take the Conservation Act into the modern day and age. I think it wasn't last changed since the 1980s. So this isn't about selling our future, as some would have you believe, but just making sure there's robust processes around that are modern and fit for current day.
And finally, looking to the track record of this government with other changes like the Fast Track Bill that have in parts undermined the environment, how can the public be expected to trust the government when they say these changes won't lead to the selling of this land?
I'd have to agree with you in the first instance that the fast track process had undermined the environment, and I don't. Every fast track project has to go through its own set of commissioners and meet, obligations to protect and honour the environment. And so we don't accept that it's a blatant, breach or an attack. I mean, most of these projects are about getting people into housing. There's massive housing projects, warm, dry housing. There's projects to increase renewable energy, which, undergird our energy supply and security. Developers have just been held for so long through red tape and, 7 years to build a wind farm that takes 3 years to build and it puts up the cost. It's just been completely counterintuitive. And so the fast track is, again, a process which just cuts through some of that red tape and green tape. But we believe that you can actually have both, that you can have good environmental and economic outcomes, and they don't need to necessarily oppose each other.
That was National Party MP Ryan Hamilton on social housing, potential end to the war in Iran, and the Conservation Amendment Bill.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Scientists in New Zealand have faced increased cuts to science funding in the last few years, with the removal of the Marsden Fund for Blue Sky Research and further cuts in this year's budget. I spoke with Professor Richard Easter, head of the Department of Physics at the University of Auckland, about what impact the current government's policies have had on science and what this means for the future of science in New Zealand.
Okay, Just before we start, could I get your name and title so I best know how to address you?
Yeah, I'm Professor Richard Easter. Fine to call me Richard. My last name is pronounced the same as the holiday, even though it's got an H in it, so the H is silent.
Great, thanks. So could you tell us a bit about the government's budget and its science investment plan and what impacts this might have on science in New Zealand?
I wish I could tell you more about it, because at this point I'm not 100% sure that I understand its full details, and I think a lot of them are still being worked out. But what we have seen is that the instruments that we used to fund science, you know, particularly the Marsden Fund, the Endeavour Fund, many of those have simply been scrapped and sort of pulled into this transition fund. And it's a huge impact on the way that science is done in New Zealand. So, you know, if you're following the news in the United States, I would say that we had a much larger and more disruptive change here. It looks like some money has come out of the system, and a lot of this is being ideologically driven in ways that are not good for science. But here it's being done by stealth, whereas in the States it's making the front pages.
Yeah, and what is the government's approach to funding in your eyes, and what do you mean by these sort of ideological...
So part of it is that they're, they've essentially defunded research into the humanities, you know, subjects like New Zealand history that were previously seen as in scope for the Marsden Fund, for instance, you know, which is a huge change in our ability to understand ourselves as a country. But from a scientist's perspective, they've focused on, it seems to be much more on sort of picking particular areas as winners, but those choices seem to be made by people who don't necessarily have a deep background in science. And it's being administered by MBE, which has a really poor track record in the management of science. You know, it's Marsden Fund, which was world-class in its ability to assess projects and to, you know, choose ambitious things to work on. I mean, obviously biased, because I was on the Marsden Council at one point, and I've been funded by Marsden. But MBE's track record managing science projects is, in my opinion, really poor. And so rather than turn to Marsden as an example of the way things are done well, they've gutting that expertise and, you know, turning the job over to people who are kind of careerist civil servants, as far as I can see.
Yeah, and with the Marsden Fund being removed, what do you think the impact of reducing support for blue sky funding will be to science in the long term?
It's like building a time machine that travels into the future and you know, kills interesting ideas before they get started. If you look at the, you know, startup, you know, tech space in New Zealand, a lot of the most interesting things have been built off things that were funded 20 or 30 years ago. So the government is focusing on a, you know, 2 or 3 year return, they're saying, which means that, you know, anything that's that short is unlikely to lead to the kind of surprises that Marsden research can deliver. I was in Wellington last week. I visited the headquarters of OpenStar, this effort to build a nuclear fusion reactor in New Zealand, which is, you know, enormously exciting even to be playing that game, but it builds on technology and high temperature superconductors that the country's assembled over decades, and it's not clear that that would get the same support that it needed to get started from, you know, in the current system. But the government celebrates it as a tech, venture, as well they might. But the policies that they're adopting means that the open stars that we would be seeing 10 and 20 years from now, that those are never going to exist.
Yeah, and what are the government's priorities in science, and what areas are benefiting the most, what areas are losing?
I mean, the government's stated priorities are things like quantum, you know, broadly defined, although it's not 100% clear to me that they know exactly what quantum is. They're very keen on AI, you know, space obviously is big. I mean, these are areas that I work in, so, you know, in principle I should be more excited. But I'm not in any way convinced that the money that's being spent in these areas is going to be well spent. To give another example, you know, this space mission MethaneSat that was backed strongly by MBE and by the New Zealand Space Agency, which is a division of MBE. You know, when that failed last year, it seemed to a lot of people that the reports that they wrote on that basically covered up a series of bad decisions that they'd made. And the fact that, you know, the problems with the spacecraft hadn't been openly communicated to the New Zealand public. And so if the people who, you know, who are directing the funding are also the ones who get to write the report, then they pat themselves on the back. So it's not clear to me is that any lessons have been learned from the things that have gone wrong. Same could be said for the National Science Challenges, which again, still saw a large amount of money.
I'm sorry, you're cutting out a bit there.
I'm sorry. How far do you want me to go back?
I don't know, 10 or 15 seconds.
So the same could be said for the... Let me go back. I'll start again from the methane sat thing, if you want.
Okay.
So the issue with methane sat was that it not only failed, but the New Zealand public was misled by statements that were made about the health of the satellite. And when MBIE came to write a report on what had happened to methane sat, they brushed all of these things under the carpet. And so if they're not accurately assessing their performance as a funding agency, then it's very hard to see how we can trust them with new expenditure. And the same is true of the National Science Challenges. They were enormously disappointing, but they were very much a creature of MBIE. And, the joke in the community was that they weren't national, they weren't scientific, and they weren't particularly challenging. And so it seems like we're making those same mistakes all over again. It's extremely disappointing.
Yeah. How have scientists been affected by these policies on a day-to-day level?
I mean, for the moment, people who are funded, are still funded. But I think it's gutting funding, for a lot of promising projects in New Zealand. I imagine that, I try to be optimistic, and I think we're doing world-class work here. We've got New Zealand involved in two, massive, projects at the frontier of fundamental science in my own personal area. So I'm, trying to be as optimistic and upbeat as possible, but it's extremely disappointing. And, the institutions are keen, obviously, to present themselves as being, consistent with government priorities. But I would say that the only reason people are more upset about this is that there's been surprisingly little coverage about it in the media.
Yeah. How does science funding in New Zealand at the moment compare to other nations around the world?
In terms of a fraction of GDP, it's significantly lower. So it's we spend less money on science than many other countries, particularly. But also, I think there's been I used to have, once upon a time I would say to people, the way that America does things is pretty good. But for their own, because of the MAGA revolution there, and in particular some of the damage that they're doing to their, health funding, which is driven by ideology, that's been taken apart. But I would say that, once upon a time, we could have looked to a bunch of examples overseas that were doing things a lot better than us. But now we seem to be quietly heading down the same destructive path that we've seen in other countries. Britain, likewise, is having similar upheavals at the moment in terms of physics and astrophysics. So it is a problem around the world. But, there was no good reason for us to go down that path. It seems to be driven by ideology and by the fact that the people who are making decisions don't understand the systems that they're making decisions about.
Do you expect scientists to be tempted to move overseas and that we might lose some scientific expertise?
I'm sure that's happening, particularly for people who are earlier in their careers and free to move. I spent a substantial fraction of my career overseas. I finished my PhD and then spent 17 or 18 years working in Japan and the United States. And I was excited to come back, but I think the ability to recruit people to New Zealand will be diminished by the changes that we've made. And I think that our ability to hold on to good people will likewise be reduced.
Yeah, and what do you think the legacy of this government with regards to science will be?
I think it's atrocious. I think we'll look back in 5 years and if we don't fix it sooner than that, wonder why we did this to ourselves. It's an entirely unforced error.
Cool. Thanks. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
I wish some of your dozy mates in the media and got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison company accepted, of course.
The Wire.
This week, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced his resignation, paving the way for new leadership in the Labour Party. Starmer has been increasingly criticised by the public and his own party for not taking decisive enough action given his sweeping majority in the previous election. The front runner to become the new Prime Minister is former Mayor of Manchester, Andy Burnham, who recently won the Makerfield by-election, putting him in the position to become the next Prime Minister. I spoke to Aaron Davis, Professor of Political Communication at Victoria University of Wellington, about the political situation in the UK, the differences in leadership between Keir Starmer and the incoming Andy Burnham, and what impacts these changes will have.
Yeah, so we've seen repeated calls from within the UK Labour Party for Starmer to resign over recent months. What's the backdrop behind these calls?
I guess the biggest push has been his incredibly low poll ratings. They went from winning the election with a landslide to often falling into third or fourth place. And the most telling thing was the local elections a month or two ago when Labour got a terrible hit and they lost a large amount of seats and did come in third or fourth in many cases. So that was the final straw. But people already could see that the polling had gone down and he barely had a honeymoon in terms of polling. So it started off bad and it just went from bad to worse.
Well, why did Starmer stay in the leadership position for so long despite calls for him to resign?
Well, you say so long. I mean, it was only 2 years that since the election. And normally you would expect in past history, when I say past history, up to 10 years ago, up to Brexit, people will be given a few years to really do something. 2 years is very little to do anything. I'd almost say it's one of the problems with the system here in Aotearoa, that you have three-year terms and you can't do a lot in that. But either way, people are used to giving people more time. Why did he stay so long? Well, he has a pattern of staying on and doing all right. And when he first took on the leadership after Jeremy Corbyn was forced out, his poll ratings were quite bad and he resisted lots of opposition to move on and step down, and gradually they picked up. You could say that they picked up a lot because the Conservative Party was so deeply unpopular at the time. He was doing what Hipkins Labour is doing now, which is waiting for things to implode and fall into power by default. And that was kind of the strategy. And it seemed to be working. So, yes, he's fought off a lot of people over the years. And one of the things he did to both get power and stay in power was really turn the Labour Party into quite a ruthless machine that kicked out all opposition. So those are the reasons he stayed. One, he'd fought off the opposition before. Two, he was very good he'd become very controlling of the party, and the people around him had that very strong control. So that had made it very difficult.
Right. And what has the UK Labour Party looked like under Keir Starmer? And what do you think will be the legacy of his term as Prime Minister?
It's hard to say. I think it's going to be a blink in the eye. It'll be like Rishi Sunak's premiership, which didn't last long. Not as bad, not quite the same as Theresa May, but I put him in the same category as those two, who are basically centrist, sensible type people who try to keep things ticking over under very difficult circumstances. And I think the problem was, you know, all of them were very much constrained by circumstances, and Starmer was too. So they weren't able to achieve very much other than seeming to be stable after the likes of Boris Johnson and Liz Truss and periods of utter chaos. But the trouble is just establishing normality is not much of a legacy. It doesn't get you very far. So that's all you can say. I mean, he tinkered a lot around the edges in terms of bits of tax policy, bits of economic stimulus, bits of this, bits of that. He did a lot of U-turns because every time he tried to put forward something, there was a big opposition. He stepped back. Unfortunately, his main legacy will be having not taken advantage of a very powerful majority to make radical change and to stay very much in the guidelines, not push the boat out too far, not take advantage of that huge majority. And it's a wasted opportunity, I guess, will be his legacy.
We've seen some jump in support for the Greens and Reform parties in the UK. Do these have anything to do with the current situation?
Yes, I mean, I would say they're a direct response to having centrist, similar style politicians of right and left in recent years. If you take out Truss and Johnson, but if you go back, apart from Truss and Johnson, if you go back to the 1990s, there's certain sort of consistency of policy that goes through. So yes, not a big diversion from things. And sorry, I lost my track of thought. But what I meant to say was that consistency has slowly alienated large groups of people, because at the same time, but on major issues, particularly the economy, large groups of people have just seen their wages stagnate, their conditions stagnate, housing's more expensive, it's much more difficult to get on. And whether a party of the left or right has come in, whatever they've claimed, it's continued in that vein. And Starmer did what many parties of the centre have done for decades recently, which is to take for granted their core vote. And that core vote has now got very upset. And that core vote, the core vote that was more from the Conservative side, but a substantial group of Labour voters, have now given up and moved over to Reform. At the same time, another substantial group, more from Labour, have moved over to the Greens, because the Greens are sounding more left. And it's, again, it's a similar situation here to here with Labour and the Greens. Disaffected Labour, disaffected National are looking to the alternative parties for something a bit more radical to change things. So I see a similar dynamic going on.
Yeah, yeah. Andy Burnham is set to replace Starmer. How do these two differ as politicians?
Burnham had a long political career. He was in the Blair cabinet for many years. He came up with Tony Blair, and he served in cabinet or shadow cabinet for, I'm not sure how long, 15 years. Keir Starmer was more of a technocrat. He came into Parliament relatively recently. His experience was running public prosecutions, an established lawyer. So Burnham's much more a politician with the good sides and bad sides of that. He's a good operator. He's much better at selling himself, much better at ducking and diving, doing the infighting, doing the steady stuff. Much better on the media. Starmer was a very sort of dull figure. Andy Burnham's much more publicly appealing. I would say Starmer also did have very little idea of what he wanted to do, other than take control of the party and move it slightly to the left, or British politics to the left. We're not quite clear what Burnham wants to do, because being from the Blairite stable, he's also quite centrist. Since becoming mayor, and since the Blair years, he sort of made a lot of more left noises, but he often retracts and steps back. So his policies may not be that much different to Starmer's. He might just be a better salesperson. But no one's quite sure, because he's a very pragmatic politician. He's a very clever politician, and he may be turn out to be more radical than many people think. But most people I know who watch these things think he may not change very much. He'll just be a better salesperson.
Yeah, I mean, what do you expect an Andy Burnham-led Labour government to look like and do?
I think a big question is where they appoint Ed Miliband, who's on the left of the party. That he's not strong left, but he's left by comparison, and whether he takes on the chancellorship, one of the major roles, and directs more policy towards more left ideas around taxation and state interventions. I guess that will be a good signal. But many of the other politicians, the frontline ones, the ones that are more well known, are very much of a style and political belief of Starmer, I would imagine. But again, Burnham might come in and appoint Miliband. He might appoint some more left people who've been sitting on the back benches for some time. So he may go in another direction, but we'll have to see. From what I read, there's quite a bit of debate inside the Burnham camp as to which way they're going to go and who is going to be appointed to which position. Although, you know, it's still, he still hasn't been, it'll still be a while before he's appointed leader and prime minister, although that looks increasingly likely.
Is there anything else you wanted to add?
It wasn't a surprise. Well, once he was allowed to stand for the by-election, Andy Burnham, he'd been held back and prevented from a previous attempt. I think the writing was on the wall for Starmer. And I think because he won that election so successfully, that has really catapulted events, made Starmer resign quicker. He thought he could probably fight on, made other people in the Labour Party, like Wes Streeting, who thought they could stand, realised that the support was going to fall in line behind Burnham. So he's obviously popular within the party, popular with a larger group of the public. So I expect him to come in and have a bump, but whether he'll be able to change things within the next 2 or 3 years before the next election is another matter.
That was Professor Aaron Davis speaking about Keir Starmer's resignation and what this means for politics in the United Kingdom.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te o taka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai ki a māua mō tēnei rā.
That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Professor Alan Blackman, National Party MP Ryan Hamilton, the University of Auckland's Professor Richard Easter, and the Victoria University of Wellington's Professor Aaron Davis. Nei rao ki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up, we've got the 1 to 4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.